So the idea of mandates seem to have caught fire over about the last 5 years, and especially this past season with the arrival of the novel H1N1 influenza. I want to note here that when I talk about a mandate, I'm referring to a policy that a worker can't totally opt out of by signing a declination form, a policy that requires some preventive measure for every employee. In this presentation, we'll take a look at various legal angles that mandate opponents might pursue, and along the way, we'll consider a few points of law that might be used to support or even create mandates. First area I want to cover is the Constitution. As a reminder, while the Constitution is the highest law of the United States, it only controls the behavior of government. In some cases, a private individual or institution can be so tied up with government as to be classified as a state actor. But from what I've been able to see in the case law, healthcare facilities aren't generally in that position. So the Constitution is really just a factor in publicly operated facilities. The provisions of the Constitution that could be invoked against mandates are the First and 14th Amendments and the Contract Clause. Here's the pertinent part of the 14th Amendment. There are two clauses that interest us, the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. There are two elements to the Due Process Clause. First, what constitutes life, liberty, or property? That's the substantive part. And second, what process is actually due? That's called procedural due process, and we'll return to that in a few slides. The most important substantive due process rights are the fundamental rights. These are things like the right to vote, to have children, and to speak and associate freely with others. It seems very unlikely that healthcare workers would ever be deemed to have a fundamental right to avoid vaccination. There is a constitutionally protected right to privacy, but it's not as protected as the fundamental rights. In Lawrence versus Texas, the Supreme Court described the right to privacy as protecting the most intimate and personal choices a person may make in a lifetime, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy. It doesn't seem too likely that healthcare worker vaccination falls into this category either. That leaves mandates to be dealt with as a normal liberty interest, the kind of choice that we think people should be able to make unless the government has an equally or more important reason to direct that choice. Thus, they're subject to a balancing test, much like the analysis in Jacobson versus Massachusetts, where the state of Massachusetts was judged to have a stronger interest in protecting the citizenry against a smallpox epidemic than Henning Jacobson did in avoiding paying a fine for staying unvaccinated. And that was going to be true unless the state's methods were unreasonable, arbitrary, or oppressive. And I would conclude that a mandate would prevail in a balancing test today. The Equal Protection Clause could conceivably come into play if a worker were to argue that a mandate was unfair to him or her because complying with it would require the worker to contravene the tenets of his or her religion. But current constitutional doctrine holds that the Equal Protection Clause isn't violated by laws that are neutral and generally applicable. A law that applies equally to all religions is fine on equal protection grounds, even if it puts the individual in a bind. It would be possible for a mandate to violate equal protection if it provided for people in some religions to be eligible for exemption from the mandate, but others not. This would be along the lines of the school immunization law from Arkansas that was invalidated a few years ago. That was held unconstitutional because it offered exemptions only to members of recognized religions. The government is not to get into the business of saying what is or isn't a religion based on how many people belong to it, even if that number is one. And it isn't for the government to say that a person's objection isn't religious in nature, even if the person belongs to a denomination that doesn't actually forbid vaccination. Religion is also protected by the First Amendment. There are two clauses called the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. But for our purposes today, we don't need to distinguish between them. It's important to note that although the Constitution protects people's rights to exercise their religions freely, this doesn't require the government to allow religious exemptions from immunization at all. But just like with the Equal Protection Clause, mandates run into Free Exercise and Establishment Clause problems if they privilege some religions over others. This would make some people more free to exercise their religions than others and would establish some religions as governmentally preferred, neither of which is okay. This might seem like it would make mandates unenforceable because anyone could say that getting vaccinated was against his or her religion, but it doesn't. The state can still assess whether the belief that gives rise to the person's opposition is truly religious in nature, and some cases haven't found that, so this is a meaningful test. The state can also evaluate the sincerity of the person's religious opposition. There's a model statute for school immunization religious exemptions that might offer some guidance here. It's described by a 2005 article in the American Journal of Public Health by Daniel Solomon and colleagues. In the event a mandate was found to violate the Constitution, the mandate wouldn't be automatically invalidated. At most, it would be subject to what's known as strict scrutiny, which requires the state to show that the law serves a compelling government interest, is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest, and is the means of achieving that interest that restricts people's freedoms less than any other method. I would argue that a healthcare worker influenza vaccine mandate could pass strict scrutiny. It represents an exercise of a state's police power, which refers to a state's right and obligation to maintain public health and safety. These are compelling state interests. While there are interesting arguments to be made on the other two prongs of this test, I'm comfortable suggesting that a well-constructed mandate could survive it. The other part of due process is more straightforward. The more important the right that the government proposes to abridge, the more process is due before the government can take that step. In Workman versus Mingo County Schools, a recent federal case from West Virginia, clarified that the danger of having an unimmunized child mixing with others in school is great enough that the officials can remove the child from school first and have a hearing on it later. I would think the same logic would apply with even more force in the healthcare setting, where many of the people we're trying to protect are especially vulnerable to severe complications of influenza. This implies that healthcare employers would be within their constitutional rights to suspend workers who refused influenza vaccine until their objections could be adjudicated. Language in Article 1 forbids states from passing laws that impair the obligation of contracts. And this might look like a constitutional argument against a healthcare worker mandate where a union contract is involved. Over time, though, several exceptions have developed, one of which is that a state can impair contracts through the use of its police power. And so I don't think the contract clause poses any problem for healthcare worker mandates. So let's move along to union contracts. Disputes arising out of these agreements are arbitrated rather than litigated, and so it's harder to track what's happening in those cases, but a number of them have at least made a swing through the court system, and from that we're able to get some sense for what the arguments look like. The core question seems to be whether a mandate is actually an exercise of management's right to make patient care policies, in which case the institution can implement it anytime it likes, or a new condition of employment, in which case they need to bargain with the union first. Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle was the first in the country to institute a mandate, and it was the first to contend with union opposition. There were actually two parallel proceedings, a contract arbitration that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and an unfair labor practice charge filed with the National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB administrative law judge found that the policy was not a mandatory subject of bargaining, essentially because preventing infections is part of a hospital's core purpose, and management had to be free to pursue that. But the Ninth Circuit upheld the arbitrator's finding that the policy was a condition of employment, and the hospital therefore was obligated to bargain before implementing it. The court reconciled these outcomes by noting that the policy had changed slightly and that the version interpreted by the NLRB didn't have any language specifying that an employee could be terminated for not complying. The Washington State Nurses Association also took action against MultiCare health systems last year. The union's request for a temporary restraining order was denied at oral argument, so there's no written record of the grounds for denial. But it's a sign that the judge either didn't view the union's case as likely to succeed on the merits, or didn't believe that union members would suffer irreparable harm if they had to comply with the policy pending arbitration. The parties apparently negotiated a compromise under which unvaccinated nurses only had to wear masks while giving patient care, rather than any time they were in patient areas, and they didn't have to wear different colored badges. Local units of the Service Employees International Union brought actions last year against two Healthcare Corporation of America systems, Sunrise and Southern Hills in Nevada, and the Los Robles Group in California. A temporary restraining order was briefly enforced against Southern Hills, although the judge did allow masking during that time, if it was required for all employees, not just the unvaccinated ones. After a hearing, the judge allowed the policy to stand pending arbitration, but management had to strike the policy language specifying that non-compliant employees could be terminated. SEIU also sought a temporary restraining order against the enforcement of the Los Robles mandate. And the court actually agreed that the policy could do irreparable harm to a union member because the vaccine could not be unadministered and the stigma of wearing a mask and a different color badge couldn't be undone. The court ended up deciding, though, that patient protection was the most important, and it let the policy stand pending arbitration, minus the requirement that unvaccinated workers wear distinctive badges. Also in California, a nurses' union challenged a mandate at Rady Children's Hospital. The court in that case didn't grant the union's request for a preliminary injunction because it found no irreparable harm would result from letting the policy stand until arbitration could occur. So the decisions are really mixed on this point. In the arbitration over the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinic's vaccine mandate, the arbitrator found that their mandate was a work rule analogous to the conditions of employment discussed in the other cases. He acknowledged that the mandate affected patient safety too, but said its effect on employees' personal conduct was more significant. The arbitrator took the view that the mandate was unreasonable because it only allowed exemptions on medical or religious grounds, not personal choice, and he barred its enforcement. I think one thing we can draw out of this early evidence is that courts are concerned about unvaccinated workers being stigmatized. Another possible lesson is the value of having external indicators that point to mandates being good public policy. In the Virginia Mason case, the Ninth Circuit said it couldn't overturn the arbitrator's decision as being contrary to public policy because there was no state or federal law requiring healthcare employers to vaccinate their workers against influenza. This might signal a potential benefit in states legislatively authorizing healthcare institutions to impose mandates. And then the University of Iowa arbitrator looked to CDC guidance on healthcare worker vaccination, noted that it didn't specifically call for strict mandates, and seemed to conclude CDC didn't consider mandates to be a good idea. So some official clarification might have been useful there. As you can see, there's a number of additional legal angles that could affect influenza mandates. I promise I'll be quicker with the rest. The ADA requires employers to make reasonable accommodations for their employees who have disabilities. If the conditions that make influenza vaccine contraindicated for an individual constitute a disability, then that disability has to be accommodated within reason. The employer doesn't have to incur an undue hardship on the business. The ADA also prohibits employers from asking employees about disabilities they may have, unless the question is job-related and consistent with business necessity. And it requires them to keep confidential any medical information that they may acquire about their employees. Issues could be raised about these provisions, but by my reading, they wouldn't be strong ones. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 forbids disparate treatment in employment on various grounds, including religion. Just like under the Constitution, religion is construed broadly for Title VII purposes. And like the ADA, Title VII requires employees to make reasonable accommodations up to the point where the accommodation creates an undue hardship for the employer. But undue hardship is defined even more expansively in the Title VII context than under ADA, so much so that this would be a pretty hard way for a worker to challenge a mandate. HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, bars the unauthorized release of protected health information about an individual. It's been mentioned as a concern, but I just don't see any real HIPAA issue with mandates, except that the employer would be wise to get consent from employees who were vaccinated at work to have their vaccination status shared with management. In any event, there's no private right of action under HIPAA. Only the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights can enforce it. The Occupational Safety and Health Act requires an employer to provide a place of employment which is free from recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm to employees. If the Occupational Safety and Health Administration were to declare influenza a recognized threat within the meaning of the General Duty Clause, it could effectively create a near nationwide mandate. But I can't see that I see this as plausible or wise. For one thing, they've shown no indication they're considering doing that. And maybe more important, it might be disingenuous to premise a mandate on protecting employees when the real motivation is to protect patients. Another possibility might be to add healthcare worker influenza vaccination to the list of conditions that healthcare institutions have to meet in order to participate in Medicare or Medicaid. There is precedent for using the conditions of participation in this way. In 2005, Congress directed CMS to try to reduce hospital-acquired infections by refusing to pay for hospitals to treat them. But this kind of tactic could be perceived as an end run around state sovereignty, and doing it this way wouldn't cover outpatient facilities at all. Moving to the state level, we might think of writing mandates into the licensing standards for healthcare professionals, such that they would need to show a record of having been vaccinated every year to renew their licenses, or for healthcare facilities, which might mean requiring that their infection control programs effectively address influenza vaccination by health, or influenza transmission by healthcare workers. The latter seems to me like a lot more feasible approach. I'll just note briefly that each state has its own constitution, and many, if not all, have various civil rights statutes, any of which could create greater protections for individual rights than what's provided under federal law. And so an institution considering a mandate should check the laws of its state. On the other side of the coin, in a pandemic, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act might come into play. Where it's been adopted, under certain circumstances, public health officials would get the would gain the power to require that private individuals either be vaccinated or enter quarantine. If they had this power with respect to all citizens, logically they could choose to exercise it selectively over healthcare workers. Mandates could give rise to employee tort claims. An employee who was fired for noncompliance could claim that it constituted wrongful discharge. But generally, that tort requires that the employer have violated public policy, like firing someone for whistleblowing. Some jurisdictions recognize a tort known as the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The treatment of both these torts depends on state common law. An employee could claim the torts of battery or invasion of privacy, although I don't think either of these would go very far. Claim of battery is negated by informed consent. An invasion of privacy is limited to a handful of situations that I don't think are present here. Torts could also work the other way. A patient who contracted influenza while hospitalized could try to hold the institution liable for being negligent in not requiring its employees to take the precaution of getting vaccinated. The breach and causation elements of negligence would be hard to establish, which may be why, as far as I know, there's never been a case like this on influenza. But a state legislature could facilitate this by setting up statutory presumptions. A different and kind of provocative idea is to use public nuisance suits, as Professor Stewart from George Washington University proposed about a year ago in regard to school vaccination. This seems promising, but it's also untested. I had the privilege of being advised by Dr. Saad Omer in the research and writing of the paper that this presentation summarizes. I thank you for your attention today.